required navigation performance. It's coming, but what exactly does it mean, especially for general aviation? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Andy McDowell, who's the Senior Manager for Airspace Services for Jeppesen. Jeppesen has been invited by the FAA to participate in a pilot program that will allow third-party vendors to develop and maintain required navigation performance flight procedures within the United States. And we're here today to talk a little bit about what that means. Andy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Paul. I'm excited about the conversation ahead.
I think we all have at least a smattering of what the definition of RNP is. It stands for Required Navigation Performance, and it refers to being able to space aircraft more closely within the airspace system based on the ability to maintain tighter tolerances of altitude and course. But tell us what an RNP procedure is.
RNP procedure is a procedure, whether it be an in-route airway or a SIDSTAR or an approach departure procedure, that is based on the ability of an aircraft and its systems to navigate at a certain performance level. And in order to truly understand it, you sort of have to take a step back and look at what we call the legacy systems of ILS and VOR, where the navigational performance of the aircraft is highly dependent upon the performance of the navigational aid on the ground and its capabilities. And what RNP does is take that concept and stand it on its head, so to speak, and make the performance capability or navigational performance of the aircraft is totally dependent upon the capabilities of the equipment inside the aircraft. So it's somewhat, I hate to use the cliche term, but it is truly a paradigm shift in the way things will be done in terms of navigation in the airspace.
Now, when you say the capabilities of the aircraft and its systems, one of those systems being the pilot?
Not so much with the pilot. It's more on the systems of how the avionics system works with the autopilot system in the aircraft, and particularly when you get into the lower RNP levels underneath 0.3 nautical miles, really becomes dependent on how well the avionics and autopilot systems are working together. And that's what the FAA is going to look at when it starts certifying aircraft down to certain RNP levels.
Now, this sounds a little scary to people who don't have an innate trust of technology, because if I read you correctly, what you're talking about is being on approach to an airport and trusting your autopilot to maintain separations which are considerably less than what are the norm today. How reliable have autopilots been in the commercial aviation world?
They've been extremely reliable in the commercial world, and it's part of the culture that is going to have to be overcome with this. I mean, you're right on here in terms of the issues. Pilots aren't used to seeing planes being able to get this close to each other, particularly in a parallel situation. And one of the benefits they're looking at for RNP is the ability to do parallel operations, particularly for approaches with runways that are closer together than standard criteria is today. And for a pilot to look out its window and see a plane almost wingtip to wingtip is kind of scary. The FAA has taken a very slow approach to these kind of concepts and getting a lot of test experience under the belts before they'll push it out in some larger way within the system to get some experience with it. But it's definitely going to be a culture change for users of the airspace.
Well, now, when you talk about parallel runways, the first thing that comes to mind is the north side at Los Angeles International, where they have identified, the FAA has identified basically a construction that amounts to a runway incursion waiting to happen. Now, is it conceivable, for example, that airliners will be landing on the two parallel runways simultaneously, as you say, wingtip to wingtip? I believe now they try to stagger them in order to keep at least a couple thousand feet separation between them lengthwise on the runways when they're landing parallel.
Yeah, they certainly do that today in IFR conditions. It's not to say that FAA will just jump straight to wingtip. Without first doing some kind of separations as they understand the concept better and start striving towards wingtip to wingtip. But Los Angeles is a perfect example. Another is San Francisco. Typically, when the airport goes IFR, they eliminate parallel operations and just go into a single operation for approach, and it really decreases the capacity and efficiency of the airport because of that. So one of the things you're looking at San Francisco is one runway being ILS operations and the one right next to it being R&P, and having aircraft come in still staggered, but still fairly close to each other, and coming in on a curved approach and lining up next to the aircraft running the ILS, so you still get dual operations on the parallel runways at San Francisco. I don't know that it's operational yet at San Francisco, but I know FAA and airlines have been doing a lot of testing with it.
Do you have a feel for how much of delays in the airline schedules, which happen during times of instrument meteorological conditions, could be resolved by this? In other words, it's been identified that that things go marginally well at busy times at busy airports when conditions are good, weather conditions are good. And you mentioned specifically the San Francisco case when the airport goes to IFR. Does this have the potential to take weather to make weather less of a factor in really bollocksing up airline schedules?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's very dependent upon the airport itself and its runway configurations and how far apart their parallel runways are spaced. But certainly for the San Franciscos of the world and the LAs where the runways are close to each other, has the potential to make significant impacts on the delays into airports with bad weather. The beauty of R&P for the future and is sort of built into the philosophy of NGATS, which is the FAA's future program for the change in the way airspace is managed and handled, is it becomes a foundation for looking at concepts we call constant descent approaches, tailored arrivals, and eventually way on down the road to the notion of a four-dimensional approach where the procedure itself from the top of what they call the top of descent point for the aircraft all the way down to the runway end is done on a real-time basis, because R&P starts allowing you to have what we affectionately call a tube in space kind of concept, where you might actually, from one plane to another, have a slightly different procedure, and that procedure is real-time based, and it allows you to navigate around the weather, still have a constant descent, and gets the aircraft queued up properly on the runway for arrival. And it's a really neat concept, but it's going to take us a while to get there as we get more experience with R&P down the line.
If I understand continuous descent, you might be 20 or 30 miles out from the airport, and at this point, the autopilot is going to instruct the airliner to throttle back and have very low, maybe idle or slightly above idle power as a setting all the way down to the runway. And what I hear you saying is that in a case where that last 20 or 30 miles is going to involve getting around weather, this system will know to set a little bit higher power level if it won't be straight in.
Yeah, absolutely. The concept is, and it's actually probably more than 20, 30 miles. It's actually basically at the beginning of the star arrival pattern where the aircraft's first descending into the terminal area for the airport, the major airport in the terminal area. But it's basically one in which the government systems, the air traffic management systems, would put up a prescribed path to the aircraft and ask for the aircraft to be at each of the waypoints or spots along the path that it's asking the aircraft to take, asking for the aircraft to arrive at that point at that very specific time. And it's all very much a timing mechanism. And the flight management systems of the aircraft have to take that input and derive the proper speed, flap, and other settings within the aircraft to assure that the aircraft reaches that altitude at that specific latitude, longitude, and at that very specific time. And that's why they call it a four-dimensional look, to ensure the aircraft comes down and gets queued up in line for the runway at the specific time.
All right, and it has to adjust for aircraft performance, terrain, any number of other things. It won't be, just a simple algorithm based on altitude loss versus time.
No, very much so. It's a very complex situation, and that's why I said it'll be a while off before we develop the systems of this capability. But it's not only looking at that single aircraft trying to avoid weather and its constant descent into the airport. You also have to take into consideration what all the other aircraft in the terminal airspace are doing and making sure you have no conflicts with other paths that the aircraft are doing. And that's why it's very important for the timepiece in that equation.
We're talking with Andy McDowell, who's the Senior Manager for Airspace Services at Jeppesen, about required navigation performance, which is going to play a big part in the future of aviation, especially commercial aviation. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Platt. You're listening to a special feature from AeroNews.
Shoot happens. Come on, you know it does. Even the world's top test pilots know there are in-flight situations you can't always recover from. Mid-air collision, control failure, pilot incapacitation. In severe emergencies, do what the world's top test pilots do. Use a parachute. Except, instead of having to bail out of a moving aircraft, you can have the safety of a BRS full airframe recovery parachute. BRS has parachutes for an enormous variety of aircraft, from experimental to light sport, and all the way to retrofits on certified airplanes. Shoot happens. Will you be ready when it does? Call BRS today at 651-457-8651 or visit us online at brsparachutes.com. Higher, faster, farther, safer. Those are the watchwords of Columbia Aircraft Manufacturing's new generation of personal airplanes. The Columbia 350 and 400 are now available with either an Abadyn or Garmin electronic cockpit. The new Garmin G1000 equipped Columbia 350 and 400 have just been introduced with the new ReadyPad. While the G1000 panel integrates all navigation and flight instruments into two high-resolution screens, incorporating GPS, nav, comm, autopilot, transponder, and flight director into one easy-to-use package. To schedule a demo flight in a Columbia 350 or the turbocharged 400, call 541-318-1144 or check them out on the web at flycolumbia.com.
Welcome back to this AeroNews special feature. I'm Paul Plack. I'm on the phone today with Andy McDowell, who's the Senior Manager of Airspace Services for Jeppesen. Jeppesen has been selected by the FAA for a pilot program that will allow third-party vendors to develop and maintain required navigation performance flight procedures within the United States. Andy, welcome back. Tell us why Jeppesen was qualified to do this work.
Well, Jeppesen's been in the business of designing airspace for about 10 years, and we do this business around the world, helping governments and airlines, et cetera, around the world with airspace issues. And we have submitted work previously, not so much in the public realm, but in the private realm to the FAA, so they understand our personnel and our capabilities and targeted us as one of the first two candidates to go through this process.
How complicated is it to design an RNP procedure? I know that's probably on a sliding scale based on where it is and what's going on and terrain and everything else, but this sounds like a job for supercomputers.
No, it's not necessarily a job for supercomputers. It takes airspace design to the next level because you're bringing the capability to maximize the procedure based on the performance of the particular aircraft that's targeted. In this case, for the third-party program, the FAA is interested in public procedures where you take into account the performance of a wide scale or wide range of aircraft. But you do have the ability to build what the FAA calls special procedures that are targeted to special configurations on a single aircraft airframe to maximize the performance capabilities of the aircraft to include possibly lower minimums because of that performance.
Now, I've heard that you use the terms FMS or flight management system and autopilot. Is this going to be an issue that affects primarily commercial aviation and primarily Class A and B airspace?
For the most part, that's where the starting point is because most of the capability exists in today in commercial aircraft as well as the high level end of business aviation. But there are plans, as I understand it from the FAA, to look at all aircraft across the board but it's heavily dependent upon the requirements they set out in the certification process for each individual type of aircraft and its capabilities.
Now, we also heard in the past few days that ITT was picked as a vendor to begin development of ADS-B, which is essentially, to boil it down to a block diagram that listeners can close their eyes and envision, a GPS receiver feeds current coordinates of your aircraft to your transponder. Your transponder then sends that information out in a form that can be picked up by both the FAA's air traffic control system and other aircraft in the area. And, actually, I'm not sure it will work if there's no ground infrastructure within a certain number of miles of you. But anyway, your aircraft is actually reporting your coordinates to other aircraft and to the system. Now, there's been some concern that for this to work properly, if it's going to avoid collisions in airspace, theoretically, every aircraft would have to be equipped with it or not be seen on other aircraft's displays. Is RNP the kind of thing here where somebody in a small general aviation aircraft who flies occasional IFR, for example, is going to need expensive equipment to get into airports into which they're flying currently without it?
Well, once again, Paul, that's going to be heavily dependent upon the requirements that the FAA finally develops in the future for general aviation aircraft. I think it's safe to say they won't ever reach the capability that certainly down to the lower RMP levels that the commercial aircraft is able to do, because you need a lot of equipment and systems on board to get down to those levels. But they should in the future certainly be able to play somehow within the RMP realm. And I wouldn't be surprised in the future as you get into the highly congested terminal airspace areas like the Atlantas and Chicago's and L.A.'s and New York City's, that if you want to start traveling through that terminal airspace, that the FAA is going to put some kind of requirement on the aircraft, whether you're VFR or IFR, to be able to navigate to a certain RMP level, just because of the congestion of the airspace and trying to maximize the efficiency of it.
Do you envision it at some point involving aircraft that are not currently autopilot equipped?
Well, studies have shown through the FAA and their research arms that to get underneath the 0.3 RMP level, you really need to have the FMS-type systems and aircraft communicating with autopilot and autopilot flying the aircraft, because when the human being starts trying to fly at those levels, the human being is just not able to keep up with the navigational accuracies and trying to follow a path that the plane's telling the pilot to do to get down to those kinds of levels. So 0.3 is seen as that level where you really have to do it in an FMS working with an autopilot configuration to get that navigational performance.
How do you test something like this in the development stage?
Typically, outside of RMP, the process is procedure is designed to the specific criteria laid out by the FAA or a civil aviation authority around the world that matches a certain criteria set, and it's developed. It's then put into a database that's loaded in what's called a flight inspection or flight test aircraft, and that aircraft goes out and tests the procedure for its flyability and other issues before it's signed off and introduced for public use. When it comes to RMP, it still typically uses that process, but an extra step is usually introduced where the procedure will be loaded into some kind of simulator before making its way into an actual aircraft to make sure that the FMS system and autopilot systems are working correctly and testing the flyability nature of the procedure before it makes it into an actual aircraft. And a lot of that has to do with safety reasons, particularly since you're getting a higher rate of navigational capability. You're getting closer to terrain, closer to other aircraft, and as an extra level of safety, by going into a full motion simulator, you can test things before getting in an actual aircraft.
Well, you're going to have to test it, I guess, under conditions of heavy airspace load, because the time it's going to be called on the most is going to be those times when, for example, that 8 a.m. to 8:14 a.m. at Chicago O'Hare, where there are 59 departures scheduled. You know, that'll be the real test, and that might be a little tricky to do if you were trying to do it with a bunch of King Airs.
Absolutely. As you get into multiple RMP installations into one terminal airspace and you're trying to garner the efficiencies and capacities at the airport, you really have to do what I call a total system look at the whole terminal airspace. And we at Jepson are designing our business to be able to tackle that kind of task, to go beyond just developing one RMP approach procedure at an airport. It's being able to have all the proper tools between people and software and everything else to be able to tackle what we call a total airspace redesign in a terminal area, because that's truly the only way that you can understand what kind of capacity or efficiency gains you can get within the airspace.
Andy, is there a website that'll be updated on a fairly regular basis in terms of how the progress is on this rolling out, or even a place within the Jepson website where listeners could get more information on RNP in general?
Well, the FAA has their own sites relative to the NGATS program where they can get information about the direction the FAA is taking. We do have an airspace design section on the Jepson.com website. It's about to be updated later this year, and we'll have a more extensive web page ourselves that goes into the benefits of RMP and some examples of work we've done and so forth. But if you look around, there's plenty of sites that start talking about RMP, and it's one everybody needs to start getting up to speed with, because it is the wave of the future, and within 5 or 10 years, I would say it's going to be pretty prevalent.
Andy, listen, we appreciate your taking some time out to explain this. We look forward to watching it roll out. Frankly, I have to say it gives me a little bit of confidence to know that Jepson is going to be involved in this, because everything I've seen from your company has been of very high quality, and I think a lot of recent student pilots would have to agree with it. Thanks for joining us today on this AeroNews special feature.
Thank you for the opportunity. We appreciate it.
You've been listening to a special feature from AeroNews. On the web, you can find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.